This is hour number two of Focus 580. It's our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers for the show, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, Jason Croft is at the controls. In this hour of Focus 580, we will be talking with author, playwright, scholar Leanne Howe. She is Associate Professor of American Indian Studies and English here at the University of Illinois. She also is the Interim Director of the University's new American Indian Studies program. She has authored several books. We'll be talking about her most recent. The title of that book is Miko King's An Indian Baseball Story. Aunt Lute is the publisher. Her first novel was Shell Shaker, same publisher. That received an American Book Award in 2002 from the Before Columbus Foundation, was a finalist for the 2003 Oklahoma Book Award. Her other published works include a collection of poetry and prose, Evidence of Red. That won the Oklahoma Book Award 2006. She was born and educated in Oklahoma. She's an enrolled citizen of the Choctaw Nation of Oklahoma, and we're very pleased that she could be here and spend some time with us. Questions, comments, welcome, of course, as always, if you want to join the conversation. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Those are the numbers. Well, thanks very much for being here.
Thank you for having me.
This book is perhaps about a lot of things, Miko King's, but at least in part, it's about Indians and baseball. And maybe that might be the kind of thing that people would not think was a natural kind of association. But just from what little I have learned now in reading this and reading about it, I suppose the first thing one would say is that Native Americans were playing things that were kind of like baseball before Europeans got here. So it would not be completely unnatural for Indians to play baseball.
That's correct. There are many, many games that American Indians were playing. Of course, stickball is one. Lacrosse is another. Indian marbles is another game. And, of course, baseball, base and ball. And I'm doing, besides the fiction, the novel, I'm doing a scholarly book that I'm working on about the roots of American baseball, and I'm working alongside the novel as well. But I wanted to open up a conversation because so many people and scholars will say, well, we just don't know where the roots of baseball came. Mm-hmm. And, of course, I'm going to try and answer that question for them, both in fiction and in nonfiction. So the game is played, as everyone knows, it's pastime. It's America's pastime. It is played counterclockwise. In the Southeast, all of our dances are counterclockwise. The mound, of course, my tribe were also mound builders in the Mississippian period, and Naniwaya is our mother mound in Mississippi. So the pitcher on the mound, the four baseball, the home plate, and then the three bases in the cardinal direction, running counterclockwise, all those kinds of things, a game without time. And those are also hallmarks of Southeastern Native culture, too. So we don't have time that operates in exactly the same way. And in the book, Miko King's, I talk about this. My character, Isolde, talks about this in a way that I hope makes it easy to understand that we don't have the same verb usage and time usages in our languages that non-Indians have. And so this is another way of thinking about the complexities of measuring time.
Yeah. That's one thing that I think is very interesting as a kind of a background here to this story and your interest in writing about Indians and baseball, both in fiction and nonfiction. The other thing that I think is also really interesting is that if you go back to the point where the government essentially was going into Indian homes and they were taking Indian kids and they were taking them away and they were putting them into what they called Indian schools and were doing things like they cut their hair and they said, you can't speak your language. You can't practice your culture. We're going to teach you to be farmers and all sorts of other things. That apparently a lot of the people who were running these schools had this idea that getting them to play baseball, the extent to which they would take up baseball was an indicator of assimilation. And they somehow had this idea that if we could get them to be enthusiastic about baseball, that would be a good marker of their ability to be good Americans. So on the one hand, we have something that was seen as a kind of a tool of assimilation. But as far as the Indians were concerned, they had a different sort of agenda entirely. And here, that's, I think, one of the important themes about the book, is that the playing of baseball becomes a kind of a cultural and political statement that perhaps for the Indians, for the people who were running Indian schools, might have had one kind of set of meanings, but for the Indians had something. They thought about this in a very different way.
That's right. And in our research, we found some documents back to 1620s through the colonial letters of Indian children playing base and ball and stick and ball with the colonial children. Mm-hmm. So the idea for us, I think, and still, if you go to any fast pitch Indian baseball or softball tournaments, you will see that kind of diplomacy that is at work in this particular game. It's a game to especially town ball. At the in the 19th century, all these towns also had base and ball, and it was a way to make friends. Mm-hmm. You know, the pickup player coming onto the field from another team playing very hard really is in relationship to a term of ours called Fannie Miko, who is he comes onto the battlefield or the council field to speak on behalf of the neighbor or someone who is not in that territory. So the pickup player has a relationship to a very old diplomatic position within our tribe called Fannie Miko. So there's a lot of things in relationship that are going on for American Indians who play this particular game. So it resonates with different cultures. One is about forming relationships. The other is about, in the same way, I think, town ball also is about making friends.
Yeah. Of course, that's not to say that Indian players don't play to win like anybody else.
Right. That's true. We want to win, and but at the same time, we want to win very we don't want to lose relationships. So today, I also have made a film called Playing Pastime with a Native filmmaker, Jim Fortier, and we track the tournaments around Oklahoma. There are 11 tribal tournaments in Oklahoma. And one of the interesting things is that in the culture of fast pitch softball today, it's not allowed to say bad or negative things while the other team is on. So you don't hear any kibitzing from the sidelines, either with the children's teams or the adult teams. You're only supposed to resonate good feelings and make friends in this game. Of course they want to win, but being negative or yelling at the umpire, these kinds of things are culturally not permitted.
Yeah. Was there something in particular that got you interested in looking at baseball and Indian participation in baseball?
Yes. That's such a good question. I was finishing up Shell Shaker, and the way I work is I usually will take a break between chapters or so forth. But in this case, I had a dream of and a man came to me in a dream, and he's holding up arms with no hands. And I didn't understand the nature of that dream, and I put it aside. The next night, same thing. This time, and the next day, the dream was about, I could see that he was trying to catch a baseball, and he still didn't have any hands, and so I followed him. And I wrote what became, I think, chapter 8 of the novel, about Hope Little Leader and why does he have his hands cut off. He's a character that I had to follow to explore he's obviously trying to play baseball without any hands. And this is the nature of the book.
Yeah. Let me just introduce again, for anybody who might have tuned in, our guest for this hour, Leon Howe. She's professor of American Indian Studies and English here at the University of Illinois. And we're talking in some about her most recently published novel. It is Miko King's An Indian Baseball Story. She, by the way, I should mention that she will be doing a reading today at the Illini Union Bookstore. This is in the Author's Corner this afternoon at 4:30. So anyone, I'm sure, in and around Champaign-Urbana should be feel welcome to stop by, to meet her, to hear her. You could even buy a copy of the book, as a matter of fact. And questions here on the show are welcome to 333-9455 and toll free 800-222-9455. There, the book has, it sort of jumps around in time from the present to the recent past to the bit more distant past, as you tell the story in these different pieces. And in the present, there is an author, a narrator, whose biography, from what little I know of yours, sounds a little bit like you. Did you, in fact, to create that character who, to in a sense, to this is, I don't know if I'm doing a good job of explaining this or not, is not only telling the story as the author, but the story is being told to her by another character. And you know, how much of your personal biography do you give to your the character of the author, the present day author in Miko King's?
Well, only a little bit. It's true. I lived in Jordan in the Middle East in the 90s, and if I had lived in Paris, I probably would have given her that history. But since I knew it, and I see a relationship in troubled areas that mirror American Indians and the federal government. And so while in 1907, what's happening to us, our people in 1907, is that our lands are being dissolved and non-Indians are taking over our lands, our farms, our state, and a state, the state of Oklahoma, is being created. And so when I look to the Middle East, I can see a relationship. And so that's the reason that she was in the Middle East. She goes there to write about travel narratives, actually. And that's not something I do. But that's really the only piece of her name's Lena Coulter. The only piece of her that's might be similar to my background. Actually, if there's a character that I think I might be, it would be Henry Day. And he's the manager of the baseball team, and he's quite a character. And he curses a blue streak, which is more like me. I try to clean up my language for the general public. But if there's a character, I think it's actually Henry Day that is very much like myself.
Your character here does actually have an experience that you had. I'm thinking of the fact that here she is living in a house in Oklahoma, in Ada, that had belonged to her grandmother, and somebody is in there doing some renovations and then knock a hole in a wall on purpose. And in that they find an old mail sack, which has all kinds of papers in it, which are in part tell the story of Miko King's. And that's how it is that your character in the book even knows that there was this baseball team. Now, you apparently had something of a similar experience. You were in your grandmother's house. Somebody knocked a hole in a wall, and here was a sack that had papers in there. What was it that you found?
Oh, you got me. There were my grandfather's papers, and we actually thought when they first, it was astounding, really. They were old love letters from a woman who was not my grandmother, but when we kind of looked at them, we realized, okay, that was long before he met Granny. And so, okay. But he had kept them all those years. And he had written also, and my grandmother did too. Both of them wrote in the margins of books when they were very young because they didn't have paper. Mm-hmm. And so poetry, recipes for healing wounds on horses, and for colic, and For one thing that we found was a little note about how to cure whooping cough by burning the edges of turkey feathers and then eating them. And that supposedly will cure whooping cough and kidney problems, too. So a lot of these medicinal recipes were in this pouch of things, and it was a treasure and a delight to find them. And so, yeah, you got me. That's another piece that's in the narrative, that Isolde is the child who had been in boarding school and also was the niece of Henry Day, and she's writing about her experiences in boarding school. I should say I'm the first generation four not to have been placed in boarding school. So from my great-grandparents, my grandparents, my uncles, my mother were in boarding school. And so I set the experience in two different boarding schools. Hope Little Leader is at Jones Academy, which is where my uncles were, and Isol, who is the child, it's the letters are in the pouch in the novel. She is at Goodland, and my grandfather was there.
Hmm. Tell me about Ada. What kind of place is that?
It is the seat of the Chickasaw Nation, and which is a sister tribe to the Choctaw Nations. I have one of the characters is named for Lena, the woman who's moved back from the Middle East, is named for my great aunt. And she was Chickasaw, and I wanted to honor her in that way because Ada is the town, like I say, the seat of the Chickasaw Nation today. So it's a very vibrant town. I live there in my grandmother's house in the summertime when I'm not teaching at the University of Illinois.
Yeah. It's great to have that kind of feeling of continuity. I'm sure that it is, and it's a thing that because for a lot of reasons, I suppose, a lot of people don't – it's experience a lot of people would never have.
It's both my great-grandmother and my grandmother died in this house, and so I feel very – and I have a wonderful memories of growing up and being in Ada with my grandmother, who was a storyteller as a child. So this is really the center of at least my family. And when I pass on, this house will go to my granddaughters. And so my youngest granddaughter, when she was about 7, we were remodeling the house. She came in with a bunch of kids, and they were like, "Ooh, look at that." And she said, "Oh, yeah, when Grandma dies, we get the house."
And Grandma said, "And I'm not in any hurry here, so don't think this is going to happen next week."
That was really funny.
One of the things that I think is interesting, and it's a notion that you play with a lot and you write about in this book, it's about time. And different ways of thinking about time and manipulating time. And I guess one of the things that I think about is your point that in baseball, the runners run counterclockwise. And that it's almost, in a way, I suppose you can almost think of it as turning back the clock. Talk about your interest in different notions of time.
Well, growing up in a large Indian community with a lot of different tribes, I had an uncle who was Apache. My aunts, I have two different aunts who are Chickasaw, my Choctaw family, my Cherokee family. I have a large family. The thing that seems to be true for all of them was the notion of about how Indians feel about time. So that we operate, I think, in a little bit out of the sphere of time. So one of the things I've been telling my students, the powwow in Chicago is this weekend. And so there are several students that are going, and I said, what time does it start? And I said, well, we've been talking about time throughout the semester. It will start when it starts. Supposedly it will start at noon, and the grand entry will happen then. But don't be surprised if it's not exactly on time. Our measurement of time, our idea about how time passes, and is very different. And I'll give you, because there's no past, present, or future tense per se in Choctaw or other tribal languages, there are only animate and inanimate ways to differentiate both gender and that things tend to be ever present, ever alive.
Hmm.
And the same thing for spirits that are alive in the house, usually our relatives or that come back. And how do we think about that gauze of past, present, and future, with the future being spirits? And so those questions actually drive the narrative. And, of course, baseball is a game without time. And that notion about the way we want to live in the universe, I think, is wholly native. I think that that the immigrants who came to America actually assimilated to native ways, and they're not aware of them. This is one game in which I'm trying to talk about our relationship of Indians and non-Indians.
Hmm.
And certainly we've been playing the game of base and ball longer than Abner Doubleday, much longer than many people realize.
Yeah. Did this quality of language that you talk about and this way of thinking, do you think that there are ways in which that has shaped the way that you write?
Yes, and other natives as well. If you think about Susan Powers' novel, which is told, it's told backwards from time. It's not a linear novel. It begins in one time period, and then each chapter almost follows, goes back in time to tell a particular story. And if you look at the way in which we also shape Native literature, is shaped by a chorus of voices, so that we don't have one single protagonist. Most often, there isn't. That the novel centers around. Actually, it's a chorus of people.
Mm-hmm.
It's a team of people that are used to tell stories in Native literature that's written by American Indians. So that. My work, I think, resonates with this idea that each person knows a particular frame of this story and is telling what happened. And so that's what I've tried to do. Also, I should say, and this is one thing I keep forgetting, it is in Oklahoma we have something called an abstract. It's a history of each particular property. And in my grandmother's house, the Choctaw gentleman who put up his allotment land to start a baseball team was on this land where it's his allotment land. So he did, in the abstract of the house, was my grandmother's house when it was foreclosed by the bank. He put up his allotment land to start this Ada baseball team, and he failed. And my grandmother picked up from the bank the allotment land. And his family is still there as well.
Hmm. So was there actually ever a team called the Miko Kings?
No.
Oh, so you made that up.
It's fiction.
What does that mean? Is that a place name? Is that a person's name?
Miko is just means leader. So the leader of our Miko is Greg Pyle. He's the chief of our tribe, and our tribal headquarters are in Durant, Oklahoma.
Mm-hmm. I do. I had a chance to talk with Susan Power when she was here not very long ago, and had a chance to read Grass Dancer, and which I thought was a very nice book. And I think it's interesting because I hadn't really thought about it, but it's what you say. It's kind of a novel in stories in the sense that there is a core group of characters that is multi-generational, and that each chapter is, in a sense, it's a story that may indeed involve various characters, but featuring one person's experience at one time, so that in a not exactly linear way, over time, you get some sense of this family and their history and maybe how people's experiences has changed over time as you look at what the life course has been of the oldest characters who are elders to the youngest ones who are teenagers or adolescents. You think that's something that is in a sense characteristic of a lot of Native American writers and the way they approach storytelling?
Yes. Especially if you look at Leslie Silko or Louise Erdrich or Scott Mamadé, you will find in a chorus of people that are people and sometimes animals that are telling a particular story, animals, plants. In this particular book, Emingo Kings, each chapter opens up with the land. Anumpa Sapotni is telling the story as well. So the land is also speaking about baseball.
Mm-hmm. We're at our midpoint, just a little bit past. We have a caller here. We'll get to them in just a second, but I should take the time to introduce again our guest for this part of Focus 580, Leanne Howe. She is Associate Professor of American Indian Studies and English here at the University of Illinois. She is Interim Director of the University's new American Indian Studies program. She writes fiction, creative nonfiction, plays, poetry, and screenplays. She has authored two novels, Shell Shaker, that was published in, when was that, in 2002, 2001?
That's right.
In 2002. A collection of poetry and prose, Evidence of Red, and her most recent is Miko Kings. That is published by Aunt Loot and is certainly available now. She will be giving a reading at the Illini Union Bookstore in the Author's Corner this afternoon at 4:30, so anyone should feel welcome to stop by. Questions here, welcome to. People want to call in and talk with her. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. The caller is in Champaign and on line number one. Hello.
Yes, this story about Native Americans and baseball is something that I had never heard before. My question is trying to move from fiction, and I guess that was reality, is why are there seemingly so few Native Americans playing Major League Baseball now? I can only think of a couple. I think there was a pitcher for the Yankees. Nobody could pronounce his first name because it was an American Indian. And then maybe an outfielder for the Boston Red Sox. But for the most part, Native Americans have not partaken of a sport that they really invented. And that's curious to me.
Oh, that's a great question. There have been quite a few. Johnny Bench is Choctaw from Oklahoma.
Yeah, Johnny Bench, or the Big Red Machine, that's right.
So he's Choctaw. He grew up not very far from Ada. Allie Reynolds is another. He's
okay.
Creek, and also from Oklahoma. Sakalexi, played, I believe, for the Cleveland Indians, and I believe that's why they took the name of the Cleveland Indians. One of the things that I find really interesting is because in Oklahoma, certainly, but our research has helped us move out across the nation, is that the tribal tournaments, there are 11 tribal tournaments where American Indians play. Originally, they started playing baseball, and they moved into after World War II to playing fast pitch softball, and are still playing it. So, when you go to Oklahoma, there are 11 tribal tournaments, and I think that's where a lot of our players still are. They're at home, their family teams. They're still hearkening back to those town ball teams. One of the most interesting things is I interviewed a woman in Oklahoma who'd played baseball at the turn of the century. She's over 100 years old, and her husband was also a player, and she's a speaker for the Chickasaw Nation. And many of these teams in Oklahoma will produce three or four baseball teams and out of their family, and so they travel together. the men's teams and the women's teams are marriages happen between players, families. So there's a really tight-knit community of teams that are still alive and well and playing in Oklahoma. And so if you get a chance, my film is touring. This is my shameless plug for the film. It's playing Pastime, and I believe it's playing possibly right now. It may have already finished at the Heard Museum in New Mexico. But I think that people don't realize also that a lot of people are native and have played for the majors, and it just wasn't a big deal. Chief Bender was another one that was playing early in the 1920s, I believe. So there's been a lot of natives. It just hasn't been, I think, widely publicized or understood.
Okay. Well, thank you.
Well, thanks. In fact, now, according to what I have read about this, and you can tell me whether I'm right or not, people will know that there was a time when baseball was segregated. White players played in white league, black players played in black league, and that the guy who's credited with breaking the color line in baseball, integrating baseball, Jackie Robinson, Brooklyn Dodgers, 1947. But in fact, I think that it is true that a Native American player actually, if you ask, well, when did baseball become integrated, that a Native American player actually did that before Jackie Robinson.
Well, certainly, and also because there's Mose Yellowhorse. He was playing for the Pittsburgh, I believe, that was his team. So he was playing on a team long before anybody thought they were segregated. He had a lot of problems, sometimes couldn't stay in the same hotel, et cetera, et cetera. Mm-hmm. But if you look at Sokolexy, he was playing in the 20s. So, again, how do we understand race? In the leagues in Oklahoma, non-Indians are welcome to come and play. Some teams have are Indians only, and some are not. It just depends on the team itself. But so I think it's a little bit different experience for natives.
Yeah. Okay. Let's talk with, we have some others. Someone here where we are, Champaign County, line 2. Hello.
Hi. Yeah, sports and Native Americans, it sort of begs a question, but I'm not going to ask it. But I was going to say that I think it's incumbent to make some statement about it, it seems. And I just been noticing that this is Native American Cultural Month, I guess, November. Thanksgiving month, I guess, is the idea. There's a group called Public Agenda that has put out a survey results called Walk a Mile, which comes from the famous aphorism, walk a mile in my moccasins, that basically does similar to what we heard about this African-American study, where they've looked at opinions of Native American history, Native American, both from Native Americans and from dominant cultural groups. And I think it would be a good place to maybe start. The fictional approach putting some kind of cultural effective awareness of this is, I think, really important, too. I'm not denigrating what you're talking about, but it just seems that given the conflict of the issue right now, I don't know how you want to address it. But I did want to make mention of that, and it probably would be a good interview, too. Thank you.
Okay. I don't know. You want to respond to that in any way? I think that he's talking about the whole mascot issue, or perhaps he had in mind just the whole question of how well Native Americans are doing in America today.
Well, we're alive and well and living in America. I think that perhaps that was the notion that we're in where I'm from, the state of Oklahoma. Oklahoma is a Choctaw word that means home of the red people. That's what the state. There are 67 tribes in Oklahoma today. And we're, like I say, there are 11 tribal tournaments that are ongoing. And the funny part of the tournament season is that the national, so-called national championship that takes place at Wheeler Park begins this the season as opposed to ending the season. So there's a lot of, there's your issue of time again. Mm-hmm. We're going to begin with this big game at Wheeler Park, and tribes come in from all over the country to play. And then we play 10 more tournaments. So that's, and there's, again, there's a lot going on in Oklahoma, but you look at New Mexico, the tribal communities, we have bounced back from being disenfranchised, disowned, and delanded three times. One of the things I tell my students is it's ironic that you look at Indians and say, well, they're the poorest people certainly in the Dakotas, when they were delanded not once, not twice, but three times. So impoverished three times officially as a federal policy to take land, establish reservations, and then be starved to death. And so it's a miracle, and it is one that we want to celebrate, of course, in November, that we're alive and well and living in the United States.
Let's talk again with another caller, and this would be someone in Urbana, line one. Hello.
Yes, it seems to me that for the population of Native Americans, there were quite a few. Jim Thorpe is better known for his powers as a football player, but played Major League Baseball for several years. Excellent fielder and capable hitter. Not nearly so good as he was with football. Chief Bender was a starting catcher for the New York Giants at the time. Christy Mathewson was playing there. One of the finest catchers in Major League history.
Yes, you're absolutely correct.
Trying to think of the player who alternated with Hank Greenberg. They both could play third base or first base. Was it Jimmy Fox?
Boy, you've got me there.
There was one that may have been the player who was later with the new Boston Red Sox. I'm sure I'm missing others, but for the population, I think they did quite well. Thank you.
All right.
Thank you.
Anything else you wanted to add on to that?
I was thinking of Mo's Yellow Horse, and he's another player that there's a 6 feet 6 inches is a book about his life and playing in and this is very early in the I believe it's the 20s. Mm-hmm. And so he's again from a tribe in Oklahoma, and so he played Major League Baseball as well as a pitcher.
Mm-hmm. Okay, to another caller here, also Urbana, line two. Hello.
This is really an interesting program, and I look forward to reading your novel. But I was interested in some more of the history of Oklahoma and Indian settlements out there, because it's also true that in the late 19th century, there was a group of African Americans who went west, and they ended up settling in Oklahoma in places like Boley, Oklahoma, Langston, Oklahoma, et cetera, et cetera. And Toni Morrison's written a novel about this. But I was wondering, to what extent did these African Americans interact with the Native Americans who were already there? Just in terms of, I guess, being neighbors or not, or having any bit of interaction, as far as you know.
Well, I think we've had a lot of interaction with African Americans that go back much earlier than that. The mid-1700s, Choctaws and Creeks, Chickasaws began to take in runaway slaves from the French.
Right.
And actually adopting them. And so we've had a lot of interaction with African Americans. That continued into that continues into now in our communities. And when I go home, a friend of mine was just in Ada and emailed me yesterday and said, oh my gosh, the town, you know, there's African Americans, there's American Indians, there's lots of Indians, and there's white people too. It's a really vibrant community. So I think that in the book Miko Kings, I'm really glad you asked this question, because Hope Little Leader's greatest love is named Justina Morrow Pay, and they met at Hampton school at Hampton Institute, they end up being lovers throughout the book, and she eventually leaves him and goes back to New Orleans, and that's the reason that the book kind of pivots. But their love affair, she's a black Indian and he's Choctaw, and their love affair really is a central core piece of Miko King's. And I wanted to talk about that and talk about our relationships, not just with whites, but also with African Americans. And that, and she's a heroic character, and her narrative is also in the novel.
Yeah. Well, in the case of the African Americans who settled Oklahoma, they were looking for independence and a chance at self-government, governance. And it's all because of the history of slavery and Jim Crow racial segregation. So they saw Oklahoma as, you know, this great opportunity to be Americans and be independent and all that. So that's why I was very interested in the joint history in that region of the country. But anyway, I look forward to reading your book. Thank you.
Oh, well, all right. Thank you for the call. Our guest in this part of Focus 580 is Leanne Howe. She's professor of American Indian Studies and English here at the University of Illinois. She'll be doing a book signing this afternoon at the Illini Union Bookstore in the Author's Corner at 4:30. And we're talking some about what you will find if you see her novel, if you read her novel, Miko King's, An Indian Baseball Story. It's recently published by Ant Loot. And I'm sure that you can pick up a copy of the Illini Union Bookstore this afternoon. Questions, welcome to 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. And another caller here, also Urbana, line one. Hello.
Hi. Mm-hmm. I am also from Ada, Oklahoma. And I was excited to hear that that's where you were from in Oklahoma. And I moved there when I was a child back in the 60s. And I've watched over the years as the Indian population has thrived and become what I consider to be such a tremendous asset to the community. But I've noted, too, sort of interesting parallel development in Oklahoma, that as the tribes have gained prosperity and become bigger players in the culture and politics, there has been this level of resentment rising, that people have this idea that the tribes are getting some sort of a free ride. And I wondered if you would comment on that cultural phenomenon, because it has disturbed me. I have found when I go back to Ada, what I see is that the tribe is greatly benefiting the community with their recreational facilities and other things that they share and open to the public.
You're raising a good point. I live there in the summer, and I was just there a couple of weeks ago. I'm not really sure that I know that there is racism there, but I haven't experienced that for myself. And I'll give you an example. One of the women at the bank is a friend of mine, and so the she was talking about the taxes that the Chickasaw Nation pays to the city to develop their roads. And the child care center is open to non-Indians, and each child receives $100 at Christmas time, whether they're Indians or non-Indians. The workout center that the Chickasaw Nation has built with that Olympic-sized pool is open to Indians and non-Indians. And if you're over 60 years old, whether you're red or yellow, black or white, the facility is free to you. They're building a hospital, a new hospital. On the front page of the Ada Evening News, which I use in teaching, was a newspaper article about sovereignty, and that Native tribes in America don't have to pay taxes to the local cities where they are headquartered, but yet we don't have to do that by law, but we do that in order to show our support of the towns in which we live. So I, you know, because I'm Native, no one has ever been really unkind and said hateful things. Maybe that's just because of who I am. So I know it exists. I certainly know that, but I haven't experienced that. And there's another reason, is that my neighbors on each side of me are in their 90s, and so they knew my grandparents, and most of the neighborhood knew my grandparents where I live. So I am still receiving the benefits of being a child in my neighborhood. I live in the old part of town, too, so that may be another reason.
Well, I think that part of the problem is just a complete lack of understanding of the sovereignty of the tribes, and the fact that the tribes, because they are part of a community, are usually investing in the community. But there's, I guess that, you know, people maybe speak more freely in a family setting where they think it's not going to be spread around. But there's this, I've had discussions with my family members about how the tribes are not paying any taxes towards roads and blah, blah, blah. And I go in and pull up, you know, information on the Internet and give to them and say, look, these are the, you know, agreements set up in all the states the tribes are contributing. But there's just, I think, such maybe a lack of understanding and awareness of how that relationship is set up. Because I'm a planner, and I lived in Oklahoma. I worked with some tribes, so I educated myself on it. But people don't understand that our relationship with the tribe is based on treaties, and you can't just walk away from those.
Right, they're business contracts, and treaty law is really American Indian law as a body of law is mm-hmm. based on these contractual agreements, and whether they were owned up to by the federal government's another question, but
right.
they are contracts. And I applaud you for the work that you're doing, so continue.
Well, I'm glad to hear that you have not been subject to any of these commentaries. I'm glad to hear people are at least polite, if informed.
Yeah. Thank you very much.
All right, thank you. One of the things that I wanted to ask you, because you not only have you written fiction, but you've also been a journalist and do nonfiction writing as well. I'm interested in the relative advantages of either fiction or nonfiction, you know, what you think, because you might have written something like Miko King's. You could have done it as a scholarly work. Or at least you could have, and I think you said, in fact, you are doing something like that that would be a nonfiction work about Indians and baseball. So what are for you the relative advantages of either approaching a subject as a journalist or as an academic and as a novelist?
The work I do in fiction is the most difficult work I do. It is the most mm-hmm. difficult act, is creating a whole piece of cloth and writing a novel. And I'm not very fast. It takes me usually about 7 years to work on a novel. And it's the most difficult, the most rewarding, the most long-lasting work that I do. That includes all of the nonfiction work. That includes film work. Writing plays is almost, for me, very easy when you compare it with fiction. This is the most difficult work I do. And scholarly work is much easier because you're building off of something that has come before. At least I do. Hmm. I read other scholars. I'm able to pivot off of them. But in fiction, in writing fiction, you begin with nothing. And you have to create a whole world, a language, a space for writers, and that's and characters. And then what happens, I was really happy to see that Andrea Lynn wrote about one of the other things I'm doing is opening up a conversation in Miko King's about what happens to the writer and the characters once the story is ended. And so to try and work through those complexities as a writer is I think the best work I do.
Hmm. Do you have some sort of feeling that the characters do have some kind of independent life apart from you?
Absolutely. They are. There may be some things, but Hope Little Leader is nothing like me. And I saw him in a dream, and I followed him, and I couldn't make him do some of the things I wanted him to do. And he's a character unto himself, and he's not. He did things that surprised me, and that's the work that a fiction writer does that I don't think can be filled in nonfiction or scholarly work. It doesn't have the same jazz.
That's the wonderful thing that continues to delight me, I think, when I hear writers talk about that. And maybe, again, I probably have made this observation before. It's not very profound that non-writers maybe don't get this, that characters do take on lives of their own, and that you as a writer, maybe you do have a plan for some character. You think, at one point, you think the story's going to go in this direction and this character is going to do this or that. And that somehow it does something that you just don't expect. And I'm sure that some people would say, well, now, wait a minute. How can that be? You wrote the story, but it is true. Person after person would say, no, I'm not sure how this happened, but this character, they did this thing, and I didn't exactly envision that, but they do somehow become entities unto themselves.
They are, and they're separate, and they move away from us sometimes. Come back here. Where are you going? And so it's a whole space in reality and time that exists outside of us as writers.
Well, we're going to have to stop. If you would like to meet and hear more from our guest, Leanne Howe, she's professor of American Indian Studies and English at the University of Illinois. She'll be making an appearance, doing a reading at the Illini Union Bookstore on the U of I campus at the Author's Corner this afternoon at 4:30. We'll be talking about her most recent novel, Miko Kings, an Indian baseball story. And even if you can't stop by there, you can go down to the bookstore and buy the book. Thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.